Hello and welcome, everyone. My name is Arzuma Seni, and it's a great pleasure welcoming to the New York Public Library the distinguished guests, Alexandra Truitt, the daughter of artist Anne Truitt, and Miguel De Becca, professor of art history and chair of the American Studies program at Lake Forest College. We're here tonight to pay homage to Anne Truitt, one of the most influential American sculptors of the 20th century, and to celebrate the publication of the new remarkable book, Memory Work, Anne Truitt and Sculpture, with a presentation, discussion, and book signing. Anne Truitt is best known for her large vertical wooden sculptures, meticulously covered in multiple coats of paint. Although she is often considered to be a minimalist, her integration of sculpture and painting, her use of color, and her dedication to the relationship between meaning and form differentiate her work from the minimalist movement. Memory Work demonstrates the evolution of this pioneering sculptor who was tireless in her pursuit of a strong cultural voice. At the heart of the artist's practice was the key theme of memory. She gravitated toward the Proustian idea that an object in one's focus could unleash a powerful return to the past through memory, which in turn would bring a fresh and critical attention to the present moment. In addition to the artist's own popular published writings, unpublished manuscripts, private recordings, and never-before-seen working drawings, Miguel De Becca offers an insider's view of the artist's great efforts to realize her artistic vision, as well as the cultural, political, and historical resonances that Anne Truitt's extraordinary work holds for us today. I'd like to thank our guests for appearing in an Art Book Series event celebrating the essential beauty and importance of art publications with discussions and presentations by artists, authors, critics, curators, gallerists, and historians. Copies of Memory Work, Anne Truitt and Sculpture, published by University of California Press, are available for purchase and signing at the end of the program. I also like to invite all of you to visit the art collection at Mid-Manhattan Library, located at 455 Fifth Avenue, where you can serendipitously browse the largest circulating collection of free books and videos covering every aspect of sculpture, including books on the work of Anne Truitt. Thank you so much for coming out on this cold night, and now it's time to turn the floor to our guests.
Thanks so much. I have all of my list of thanks. So first of all, to Arezou for setting up this event, also to the New York Public Library. It's really exciting, thrilling to be here and to be invited to share the stage with Alexandra in conversation. To the audience, thank you. It's winter. It's a weeknight. I understand it's dinner time, so thank you for being here. And I see so many familiar faces, which is always feels very warm and great. So one last thing, I guess, to thank the publisher, University of California Press, that for supporting me. This is my first book, and they have really been supportive to me from the very beginning and of this project. The press represents the work of so many artists, artists who are women, artists who are not New York-based, and it was really thrilling to work with them and to see this book realized on their list. So I'm going to lay out the agenda a little bit, so a kind of a roadmap to let us know where we're going tonight. I'm going to start off with introducing the work a bit, describing my own connection to the work, which will then hopefully flesh out some additional information about the artist. I'll say a few words about the contents of the monograph, but I don't want there to be any spoilers, so I will leave you to read those exciting bits in the book itself. And then I will wrap that up hopefully quickly and turn to a conversation with Alexandra, the artist's daughter, to discuss some of the major themes in Truitt's life and art, and to discuss from the estate's perspective the process of researching Truitt's body of work. So here we go. I wanted to show a few assorted images of Truett's work because, in case you're not familiar with the work, Truett was known as one of the very first sculptors to work in a pared-down minimal style in the early 1960s, really a pioneer and innovator of a movement that would eventually be known as minimalism later in the 60s and in the early 70s. As Arezou's introduction pointed out, Truett is known especially for the color of her sculptures, which evades precise definition, owing to the underpainting, owing to the technique in which the sculptures are rendered. The sculptures you're looking at here are industrially fabricated wood, which is painted with many, many coats of cross-hatched pigment. Truett was also a painter. This is a wonderfully remastered photograph of paintings that appeared in a solo show in the Minami Gallery in Tokyo. Truett was also, here's some additional paintings, these rather minimalist studies in contrasting hues. I don't know if any of you saw, I can't remember, maybe it was at the end of December, but Peter Sheldahl had written a review, I think, of Robert Ryman, but the key piece in that review is that he characterized the work as coming from the noticing generation, and I loved that because there's a certain kind of precision about noticing. It's a very careful, slow process of noticing these small differences between hue and color, and that's true of the paintings as much as the sculptures. And also works on paper. Truett was a very accomplished draftsman. These are works that she called drawings, despite that they're paintings on paper, ranging from rectilinear forms that you see here to other geometric forms, as you see here, geometrically diverse shapes. And this, also an illustrator, maybe not quite, but I was reminded in preparing these remarks of this whimsical illustration that Ingrid Cishi, I believe, commissioned for The New Yorker, as a self-portrait, which I think this is a very entertaining take on that subject. Arezou asked me, and I think it is appropriate to say in this forum my own engagement with the material for the first time. In fact, I was introduced to the work of Truett as a sculptor through a show at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Los Angeles, which was curated by Ann Goldstein, A Minimal Future, Art as Object, 1958-1968, which was held in 2004. And what I want to say about this is that it is so vital for museums to be intelligent and daring in their exhibitions, because from the perspective of a scholar, from the perspective of an art historian, it's really museums that that engage and that inspire and that show us work grouped in a way that we may not have thought of before. And in fact, it was this show that first opened my eyes to a diverse a range of practices of minimal sculptors, of minimalist artists. The image on the left is an assortment of Truett's sculptures. And on the lower right, this is so interesting. I was discussing with Alexandra earlier, this is like totally subconscious, but you can see in the foreground is a Truett sculpture. I believe that's Platt. And then in the background, you can see a cube, which is sort of cut off by the wall. That's Tony Smith's Die. Behind that is Ronald Bladen's Three Elements. And then I'm not sure that the red artwork on the wall may be a very early Donald Judd. And all of these artists play a role in my book. And I totally did not recognize that was most likely lodged in my brain, very, very deeply inserted in my brain from seeing this this really wonderful exhibition. So if you work in a museum, bold, daring, keep going. Okay. If there was one single sculpture that defines this entire project, it is this one. It's a sculpture from 1962 entitled Hardcastle. And I was absolutely struck by this object, what I would call a visceral reaction, which was already outside the parameters of what I had expected of minimalist work. Part of it had to do with its size. It's about 9 feet tall. Part of it had to do with the sense that it was hovering, looking at me maybe, or hovering in my plane of vision rather unsettlingly, which owes to the fact that there are small risers which are affixed to the base. So in fact, the work appears to be separated from the floor by just maybe half an inch or an inch. And the title of it, Hardcastle, was especially alluring to me. It's a surname. I didn't know that at the time, but just the invocation of this idea of Hardcastle, which was something strong and ominous and gothic, that really got my attention. So I was immediately drawn in by this work, by this specific sculpture. And I was a graduate student at the time, and so I went back and furiously researched all that I could about Truett, and I found that she was a friend of the modernist critic Clement Greenberg, and in fact, Greenberg had written favorably about Truett's work in several occasions, including a review in Vogue magazine in 1968. Those of you who are art historians in the room might know how unusual it was for Greenberg to have championed an artist who was a minimalist because of his own preference for expressionism and self-enclosed composition, let's say, and rather vehemently against minimal art. So I thought that was interesting, a good starting point at least for a graduate student. And that's really how I got started on the project, trying to reconcile this idea of this this emotional vitality that I felt emanating from these sculptures, and then trying to place that, in a sense, within what I knew about minimalism to hopefully expand those parameters and know more. These are the three best-selling books written by Truett herself. So I want to, take the opportunity in this forum to address the fact that Truett is an extraordinarily well-known artist as much for her visual work as for her literary work. And I think that's very important to know. I think it's important to know that she wrote absolutely prolifically. She was a prolific writer her whole life. And I think that the artist intended her legacy to be as much of a visual, her legacy to be as much of a visual one as a literary one. So I wanted to make sure to say that. These books are written in the form of episodic journal entries, and they describe in language that is quite erudite and passionate her own life and art, and dwells at length on the particularity and maybe even the peculiarity of life as a working artist. I'll say a few words about her biography, although Arezou did such a wonderful job earlier, but I think this helps situate us in the conversation that follows. Anne Truett was born Anne Dean in 1921 in Baltimore, and she spent her childhood on the eastern shore of Maryland. Maybe some of you are from there, or maybe you vacation there. It is a very interesting geography, which we'll get into in a bit. And in 1943, she graduated cum laude with a BA degree in psychology from Bryn Mawr College. I mention that because Bryn Mawr was very much a beloved presence in Truett's life. She worked after college as a Red Cross nurse's aide at Massachusetts General Hospital until the end of World War II. She served in the wards at night after working as a research assistant in the hospital's psychiatric laboratory during the day. Where I want to go with this is that throughout all of this, she wrote poems and short stories, that these are these exercises in her literary aspiration are preserved in her archive, which is at the in the Special Collections Department at Bryn Mawr College, an archive that Alexandra and I know very, very, very well, and one that we will discuss momentarily. It's very interesting to see in the archive the number of boxes devoted to drafts of poems. I mean, there was just boxes and folders and folders and boxes of poems, which is really wonderfully interesting to see that she was a literary person. She had these literary aspirations really from the very beginning. These poems contain so many images that recur throughout Truett's life. There were so many poems about sand dunes and yellow sand and standing on the shore looking out at a horizon, yellow sand and a horizon. So this, you know, this recurs. I will skip this in the interest of time to say one thing that drew me in, and perhaps this is kind of crazy, but and looking at all of these drafts, I became increasingly convinced that the position of the poem typed on the page was in itself a kind of training for the spatial concerns that emerge in the later works on paper. The place that Truett put a word on a page was incredibly deliberate and totally spatial, and I saw a absolute consistency between the literary and artistic parts of her practice. There were certain moments of delight, especially when you read a poem that may direct you to a sculpture. So in this particular poem, I love, it's kind of a Gertrude Stein or James Joycean, blue sea and above it yellow hill and beside the hill a green field and a blue sea and a yellow hill and a yellow hill and a green field and a green field. You get a sense of the rhythm. I get a very Steinian rhythm with that. But anyway, and then the last line is, and that was a sea garden. So this is great because there is a sculpture which is titled Sea Garden, and you would think, aha, you know, light bulb. But in fact, where I want to go with this is not aha, that we need to, or what I needed to do is to resist the temptation to make these transparent relationships between what the artist wrote and what the work was titled and what the work was really about. And that's what my book is about. It's about the capriciousness of memory. It's about the fungibility of memory. It's about the fact that we misremember things all the time, and that a memory, as we might conjure it at one point in our life, is very different than the memory that we might have later in our life. And it's really our present context that dictates how those memories arise. And this, the keystone here is Proust, again, which was mentioned in the introduction, and Truett translated secondary literature on Marcel Proust, a project which she completed in 1955 for Rutgers University Press. The scholar was Germaine Bray. The title was Marcel Proust and the Deliverance of Time. You can see this is from the title page of the book. And one thing I'll say about this in terms of her biography is that she, by 1953, 54, 55, when this translation was taking place, she was already very much considering herself as an artist. She was making clay sculpture and wire sculpture at the time. This project really turned things around. 1955 is a turning point in many ways. Number one, because she became devoted to Proust for the rest of her practice, and then also because you see a kind of winding down of her literary self and a ramping up of her visual artist self. And I think Proust is really the crossroads there. And I think that that was something for me that was extremely revelatory. And then really, the last thing I want to say, because I hope you all buy the book and find out more for yourselves, is that memory, even though it's absolutely a core dimension of our lives as human beings, is really not something that is invited into what one expects when they think of minimalism and the way that we think about and the way that we have thought about minimal art for in the way that it's been theorized and written about by art historians. And just two examples, something like Frank Stella's Jill or Tony Smith's Die, this idea of what you see is what you see, this idea of the present moment of experience being the one that is really the important one, or Tony Smith, which is this statement that I was not making a monument has really become synonymous with minimalism. And so this idea of anti-memory in a certain sense, and instead this favoring of being grounded in the present moment and grounded in one sensation in the present moment. But what I'll say is that is what Truett's work is about, is being grounded and present in the present moment, but allowing, of course, these memories to come through and to break through the present, to not seduce us back to living in the past, but learning from the past, learning from our past imagination and from past history in order to better inform the sensations that we have in the present. So I'm going to bring my yammering remarks to a close now and then yammer with Alexandra a bit. So here we go. Okay. Oh, thanks. All right. So the first thing that I wanted to talk about was, I mentioned earlier Easton, Maryland, mm-hmm. and that's the first thing that I really wanted to talk about, and talk about it in the importance of it as a place, and Easton as a geography. So I'll just leave that as a prompt, and I'll allow you to.
Geography.
Yeah, geography, yes.
So I think, you know, we've talked about this. I think my mother always knew where she was in the world. I think she always knew when the last equinox was. She knew when the next solstice was coming. She knew, you know, what axis the earth was on. She always situated herself on the world the way she did in that self-portrait, right? That's her. That's just this little person on this planet in the star system, everything. She always oriented herself everywhere. And so Easton was the place that all began. So as children, we would be taken by my mother, and I was talking to my brother Sam, who is here tonight, about this the other day. My mother would take us to Easton, and we would all sort of troop behind her, and she would go along, and she would say, "All right, stop," and look down, and we'd look down, and there would be these bricks, and she would say, "Look at the brick pattern." You know, we'd look at the brick pattern, or she would say, "Look at the way that window meets the clapboard," and we would have to look at that. She would explain the horizon, so we'd just be driving along doing nothing, and then she'd say, look at this, you know, horizon," which, of course, like as children, you're not always looking at your landscape so far away. And she would say, "Look at that one little tree that's just standing there," or look how the land disappears into the sky. "Look at the estuaries. Estuary, what's an estuary?" Everything was a thing. Everything was something that related to something else that oriented you in the world. So as children, it was important to her that she tell us this and kind of decant it or something. So Easton became this thing that, you know, in as much as it was a source for her, became something that we understood meant something to her. So whenever we had a question, it was always like, "Does this relate to Easton somehow?" And it almost seemed as if, you know, unless I didn't even know she lived in Asheville. I don't know if we've talked about this. Like, I didn't even know she lived in Asheville until we started really looking at, like, her whole biography. It was like Easton was the thing. That was where she was from. Yeah, she lived in Asheville probably longer, or lived in other places longer, but nothing. It was always Easton. So that's I guess what I remember.
Right, and in addition to that, this image is of the artist is in the center, and this reminds me of, as a child, she was quite myopic, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that she writes about that myopia as being also a defining experience for her as a child the way that she sensed the world was really, in a sense, haptic because she couldn't see.
She couldn't see anything. And she used to talk about, in Easton, she would talk about being a child and sitting in her room and looking out the window and moving to the side so that a tree would line up to the middle, or moving this way so that something would line up in the window. She's always trying to make everything go to the shape that she wanted it to be. And when you look at this, you can see like the fence that maybe ended up as something like those early sculptures. This little bench on the side looks like very minimal for its time, right? Mm. These are her twin sisters. It's my Aunt Harriet, Aunt Wheezy, right? She's in the middle. And this would be one of the fences that she would have peeked through, you know?
And the surfaces of the buildings.
But she couldn't see anything. Sorry, right. That's what you were saying. She couldn't see anything, so everything had to be close up. So her whole world was, you know, whatever she could see. And it wasn't until, what, fifth grade when she went mm-hmm. to... She was taught at home by a governess who she loved. And then she was sent to elementary school. And when she went to elementary school, they realized she couldn't see. So they got her glasses. And when they got her glasses, she was, like, amazed that a tree had leaves. She just thought leaves were on the ground, tree was a blob. So it was, yeah, that.
Let's see. Okay, here's the house on South Street. This was the childhood home. You've visited that house since, right?
Yeah. Have we been there together? No.
No, we didn't go to Easton together. We went to Japan together. I'll take Japan, and then this is what you're referring to, that these forms,
right,
these shapes,
early works are early about works. Fences mm-hmm. and divisions. And about, yeah, you go ahead.
Right.
No. Easton Meeting House, you go back.
Oh, that's right. Well, just to mention, so this is what you're looking at in the upper left is the Friends Meeting House, the Quaker Meeting House in Easton, which has such a peculiar, okay, no laser. There's a peculiar shape to the roof. It's called a salt box shape. And this shape is mimicked in the tops of one of the pails in First, which is the first work she did in a minimal style, which you're looking at on the lower left. And then these other sculptures, one and Green Five, I believe, are resonances with this white wainscoting, the lattices, the doors, the boards that are characteristic of the architecture in Easton.
Yeah, and you know what I just found out? Hmm. Actually, I forgot. This morning when I was reading, we're working on the... At one point, I forced my mother to tell me something about the titles of the work. And so she told me about the title for each sculpture and what it meant and some little things about it. So we've been transcribing those and sort of looking at what she said about each sculpture. And one of the things that she said about First that I never really occurred to me is that she drew each one of those pickets. Like she drew the picket and then they cut it out into that shape. Mm. It's not like three generic pickets. I mean, I know they're all different and you've written about that in your book beautifully, but she actually drew them on. She felt like she had to draw each picket differently.
And what's so interesting about this is that she said that if she was able to get it to be freestanding, she would have, but she couldn't, so that's why there's a base.
She couldn't figure out how to make it stand up without having a ground, so she had to stick it in that plank that represented the ground.
Right, and what's interesting is that I think if there was no base, that would have been like especially minimalist. You know, that would have been
super
like
special minimalism.
really early.
Super ubi.
Okay, let's move.
But those aren't that small. I mean, those are those are bigger than that sculpture. I mean, the pictures are.
Let's move. So this is the first house that they lived in of course, on the left, Anne Truitt. On the right, James McConnell Truitt, her husband. I didn't mention James Truitt was a journalist, and this accounts for their peripatetic lifestyle, having moved from Washington to Dallas to New York to Washington to San Francisco to Washington to Tokyo to Washington.
And then my father to Mexico, my mother staying in Washington.
So this, you get a sense of this peripatetic lifestyle. But this was the first Washington
Yeah, I don't know really where this is. This is a fence again. Always has to be a fence. But maybe my brother knows. I never have really known where this is. I don't either. I think it's the first house they had. They're super young. They're married because she's wearing a wedding ring. But I think it's Washington. But it's really early and a fence. Like that fence is funky, right?
And George, this was also in Georgia. What's sort of interesting is that Washington, D.C. at this time, it seems like a kind of unlikely place, but there was really a sense of an artistic and literary avant-garde that was in Washington at the time. No resolution.
Wait, what did you say?
No.
Sorry, I was goofing
around. So there was the idea that you might be familiar with D.C. in one way, but that there was actually the presence of a very lively artistic scene in D.C. in the 1950s and 1960s, and the Truitts were very much a part of that. James as a journalist and Anne as an artist, and that they were inserted very much into this scene. But I want to get to Dallas for a minute.
Really?
Yes. Okay. Well, here she is. So this is the studio in Dallas. This is going to be 1949, 1950.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that is so intriguing to me about this picture is that this was the studio that Truitt worked in when she was a student at the Museum of Fine Arts in Dallas. But that she established this lifelong, very important studio practice there, and she did so in the company of an artist by the name of Toby Schneebaum.
Schneebaum.
So, if you
so would. Yeah, and when they lived in Dallas in 49, my dad was with Time Life, and my mother was taking at the Dallas Institute. She took some lessons with Octavio Medellin, mm-hmm. and she learned how to cast. And these figures that she was making are sort of figurative. She was making these wire structures that you can see back here that she would then cover with clay and fire. But what happened in Dallas was that they started going to Mexico. So when they went to these trips on Mexico, one time they were in Ajijic, which was kind of like what she used to describe as like an early hippie sort of scene where everybody was just kind of hanging out. And Toby Schneebaum was down there with a bunch of friends. And I think they just kind of picked Toby up. I mean, everybody just kind of, sitting around. They brought Toby, who's an anthropologist and who wrote Keep the River on Your Right and lived with cannibals and had this incredible adventurous life, alternating with living in New York and West Beth. And he lived with my mother in Dallas when my father was off on assignment, and that's when she started the studio practice. Together with Toby, they would get up in the morning, go to the studio, have some coffee, have breakfast, go back to the studio. He would paint. She would do whatever she was doing, the casting, the cement, clay.
Wire and clay.
And then they would have lunch. They would go back to work some more. They would have dinner and then go to bed and do the same thing the next day. So every day they worked all day long. And she didn't have children. And later when she wrote about, fitting in her work in between children and carpools and all that, she'd already established it. She established this in the late 40s, mm-hmm. that she just worked like a dog all the time. What dog?
What's so interesting is so much happened between 4 and 6 in the morning. I mean, it was really
busy.
Letter writing, studio practice,
right.
Reading. I mean,
hard schedule.
The intellectual work happened early. It's maybe a lesson for us.
And
all.
formed in the 40s.
And formed in the 40s, formed in
49. But before that, it was just writing. So she would get up and do the same thing with writing. So now she just replaced writing with visual art.
This is Teyuchitlan, which is near Ajijic. And this I love the compatibility of these two images. On the left, you see this pre-Columbian ruin. And then on the right is one of the clay works that Truitt did very early. Clay work that we've been referring to, and you can see it has a kind of morphological resemblance.
And those clay works were like the first thing since Easton that appealed to her. So like the pre-Columbian culture and that Aztec culture of having like a plaza with these different, architectural elements was the closest thing to Easton she probably had seen.
That's a wonderful point. And the lake, there's a lake in Ajijic, which mm-hmm. has this it's very large lake, so it seems like it's an ocean, and it has this very straight horizon. And so I can imagine that having these, the plazas, the pre-Columbian ruins, the structures that we just saw on the shore of a lake, I think it's absolutely consistent with this idea of being grounded and oriented and situated and positioned very geographically. That was all of the same piece.
Yeah, and in Easton, I don't know if anyone here has been to Easton. I know my brother has. Raise your hand. So, but Easton is like super flat. I mean, it's like it's crazy. There's not even any like dips. You can like drive it all like one-handed. It's like so flat. The whole thing is flat. And there's just these estuaries that come in and go out. Flat. So flat.
I love
it's
this.
Fun, right?
I love this photograph. This is a house in Belvidere, California, Marin County, that they built together.
They built it when my father moved to San Francisco as what? Time Life again? Oh, mm-hmm. Time Life moved him?
Yes, I mean.
To San Francisco. Mm-hmm. They didn't want to live in San Francisco, so they built this house in Belvidere, which was like this little community where everybody built their own houses, and they forgot to put outlets in the rooms, which my mother said was always like a real pain. But this was their living room. So this was Noland painting, mask?
U-Peak, yeah. In
pre-Columbian things, more U-Peak, little soapstone seal, this whatever, super modern.
The Victorian furniture,
it's
though,
nice,
which
right?
is very, I love the blend between the new and the old.
Well, that furniture, my mother would always, every time we'd say, like, can you get some new furniture? She'd say, no, I don't buy furniture. I inherited furniture. Be like, so she never bought a piece of, well, from IKEA once. But that was it. Like, who doesn't? But, yeah. She never bought furniture. She inherited it.
So I'm going to abbreviate the next few slides because I do want to transition us to talking about Japan, which is very exciting work that Alexander and I did together. But I'll simply say this is what you're looking at here is the interior of the studio in Washington, D.C. that she had when she began making the earliest minimal work, which is in Twining Court, located in DuPont Circle, off of P Street. And this is the interior of the studio. That is Wataga, right?
Tor.
Tor, that's Tor. So the sculpture is entitled Tor. And then, say a word, if you would, Alexandra, about the paint on the wall.
So this is picture's kind of nice because what you can see is when she started making these early, really big sculptures, she would figure out how tall she should actually make them, whether or not they were too tall, too small, if it fit the proportion that she, wanted to feel. So she would draw on the wall. She'd outline on the wall. You can see the marks there, how big it should be, and then she'd back away from it because she didn't have any other way of making a maquette. She wasn't able to see something small and then say, oh, that'd look great, 10 feet, 8 feet, which she got better at later. So then she was just drawing it on the wall, like a drawing, backing away from it and going, oh, yeah, that's the right size. So you can see her working that out on the wall.
And then on the door, there's a drawing of is it a hand print?
It's a dipped hand
print. It's a dipped hand print. And that.
But she would do that, like, sometimes, just put her hand in paint and then just put it on a piece of paper. She liked to do that.
And followed her from studio to studio?
If she could move it, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, same stuff all the time. Same clothes.
The text down here, now there will be three in Washington. This is something that is I dwell upon at length in the book. This was something that Clement Greenberg had said when he saw Truett's work in the Twining Court studio, meaning that the three in Washington, the three artists that he thought were particularly robust, one was Ann Truett and the other two were Kenneth Noland, as you see represented on the left, and Morris Lewis on the right. This is the card from the exhibition, her debut exhibition at Andre Emmerich Gallery here in New York in 1963. Something interesting about it is, of course, the lack of a first name. Emmerich was, in a sense, deliberately erasing the gendering determination of the artist as for her first name. And first, the picket fence sculpture does not appear in this exhibition, no doubt because it
would have been too
domestic.
Yeah. This is the interior of that exhibition. I think it's so funny that the gallery is carpeted, which is any gallery in Chelsea today, it's like there's a certain look, and carpeting is not it. So
it might come back. You never know. Maybe it'll come back, right?
Maybe it'll come back.
Cozy? Carpeted gallery?
And this is a tiny room, right?
Well, that's the sculpture that ended up at MoCA. I mean, that's what you saw at MoCA, right? Is that sculpture right there.
It's just such a small room.
Looking so different with a lot of more room around it.
Right, precisely.
I mean, can you imagine this room? It must have been like a consignment store.
And who installed the work? Who curated it?
Bill Rubin, Clem Greenberg, and Ken Noland.
Okay. I do want to move now into talking about Japan, because we had a time. When Alexandra and I met about 10 years ago, I had a lot of questions about this work in Japan. As I worked steadily on the project, I had gotten to a place by about 2011 where I had written about the work up until 1963, up until the Emmerich debut. And I wanted to carry my manuscript forward to 1968, which is the beginning of the very regularly formatted columnar work, the parti-colored work. And I couldn't reckon with, in a sense, this period, or I wanted to reckon with this period between 1964 to 67, that Truitt lived in Japan and was incredibly prolific in Japan. She made sculpture there as well as works on paper and paintings. So I was very curious about this work. I'll show you a picture of it all in one room. This is in the basement of the Corcoran.
This picture is like in the basement. I don't know if it's the basement. It's where the work was stored at the Corcoran, where Walter Hopps let her store the work when we came back from Japan. So this is all a combination of Japan work, which is this stuff. These are Tom Downing paintings. And then the rest of it is Truitt with this Morris Lewis in the back. What was your question? This is just like before, when they were organizing the retrospective. They got everything out. The retrospective that was at the Whitney and at the Corcoran, they got all the work out, and that's when she looked at the...
That's right. So there was this massive moment of retrospection in 1971, and then the actual retrospective was in 1973-4. Winter of 73 into spring of 74. And so what motivated me as an art historian was essentially this question for how do we account for these sculptures which Truitt had destroyed. Mm-hmm. She destroyed all of the sculptural work from Japan in 1971. And I had, in a sense, inflated this in my mind as like the question that I wanted to answer. It ended up being the least important question. As I learned more about the work. So when I approached you and I said, what about Japan, from the estate's perspective?
It was the thing we didn't want you to ask about. Right. Like, Japan was not organized. Because Japan was a period where the work had been exhibited, so the only way to date the work that we didn't have, because a lot of the work that was exhibited in Japan stayed in Japan, we could only date the work by things that looked like other things. It wasn't organized enough, and we didn't have enough information to have everything cataloged. So I couldn't answer any of your questions. I mean, I could answer about why the work was destroyed, and she wrote about that in her books, and she wrote about that. And there's papers in the archives that explain why she destroyed it. And if you read all those, if you put those all together, you know, you can see why she just... You understand why she destroyed the work, but we had to get to that. But then the work that was there was the works on paper, which she always said was the most important thing, was how she found her way from the work she did before she went to Japan to the work she did for the rest of her life when she came back from Japan, and that transition,
right,
development was in the drawings.
That absolutely, and I think that is what that there was a sort of unbroken line, there was an unbroken narrative that I could construct. So it really wasn't this iconoclastic moment where it's like I'm destroying everything and I'm disavowing it.
But that it also didn't mean that we couldn't, it didn't mean that when you asked about the sculpture, it also meant that I had to be able to say, oh, that, yeah, these 10 ones that were called this, that were these sizes, you know, you have to recreate them in order to say that they've been destroyed accurately. So I couldn't do that because right. there wasn't enough.
And you were all about the chronology. I mean, you were like tenacious about chronology. I was personally less tenacious about chronology, but I was very interested in creating this narrative. And so we worked side by side a lot. We worked in the archive of Bryn Mawr College to put this all, some of this material from Japan together. What I'm showing you here is an exhibition poster of Color and Space. This was an exhibition at Minami Gallery in Tokyo, the first and, to my knowledge, only exhibition of what was not at that time known as minimal art, but was essentially minimalist art in Japan. And we found some fairly surprising things, such as in this review of Color and Space from Bijutsu Techo, which is the art forum of Japan, we saw this is the sculpture that was included in the Color and Space show, and we both looked at each other and
oh my God.
Yeah.
Like we didn't even know that existed. Like,
what is that?
And so we had to find.
And you said, I don't know. And I said, I don't either.
But that was like, it's like the way we worked together was like, I always want to call it collaborative, but it's not, it's just collegial. But we were looking at the same material, but my use for it was completely different than yours. All I wanted to do was catalog it and get it organized, and you wanted to do whatever it was you wanted to do. But it's
right.
Well, write a so book. But we were working with the same material, so we would pull out some stuff and go like, oh my God. And at one point we found a list, I don't know if you have a picture of it,
of
we were working on sculpture, and I was like, oh, I've got this covered. I've got every single sculpture. Now we know where they all were, what they were destroyed, this, that, mm-hmm. The names, the dimensions. And then we found this list of, like, completely different titles.
Yeah, the colors matched.
So it had to change everything.
And the proportions and the colors matched the inventory that you had, but the titles didn't.
So annoying, right?
Well, and so this was what, as an art historian, this is the part that I was really interested in because of what I said earlier about Truitt, she titled something in a working drawing or in the way that she worked. She titled something, but then she titled it and retitled it as she kept working.
Which is fine, but it's fine, but it's not that easy
so
when you're coming across these things.
So one great example is A Wall for Apricots, which is here blue, red, tan, and white. And I want to show you, this is when I saw this list, the Wall for Apricots that I knew was the one on the right, a 1968 sculpture called A Wall for Apricots.
Yeah, which she has a whole story about. So she has a whole story about making this sculpture, Wall for Apricots, right? A lovely story about how she was at a dinner party at the Stearns and everybody was naming the three things they loved. And Mary Meyer's favorite three things were apricots, white walls, and something else. She could never remember the third thing. And I'm surprised she didn't make something up because that's what she usually did. So she's like, this is from Mary Meyer. It's this special sculpture. And I never knew there was even a second Wall for Apricots because that was always like the story. There was a beautiful story. There's a beautiful sculpture. It all fit together perfectly. And then when we were going through the things, all of a sudden there's like a Wall for Apricots from Japan that was like completely, you don't know what to do with it because it existed. So it has to be two Wall for Apricots now, which is fine for you because you're a writer. Not so good for my...
Right.
The records,
that's
but
right.
We can figure it out. But
this idea that memory is so interest carried and interest driven by present experience, that this existed for her as a wall for apricots in this moment, and then.
But it's not
later
that story at all. How do you figure that out? I mean, it's not. So what was that wall for apricots?
It was the. It was.
But that's
the
not
same
those colors.
But it changes. It's right. Well, I
it's
exactly.
Not the, it's not. Yeah, as the story doesn't work anymore.
this is an example of the material we had to get through, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of receipts, inventories, handwritten letters. I mean, this represents a week of work.
Oh, yeah. And it wasn't organized
at all in
the papers.
A lot of trips to Panera. We went to Panera and Bryn Mawr.
Reorganized everything about 100 times.
And we organized everything at Panera. So many thanks to the bread makers at Panera. Oh, this is interesting. So this is another example of our shoulder-by-shoulder collegial collaboration. How's that for alliteration? This is Summer Run, and the Alexandra called me when she said, you know, we do have one remaining Japanese sculpture in the estate. Would you like to come by and look at it with me? And I said, yes. And we were interested because we knew we were going to Japan, I think, at this point. And
right,
we were
right,
going
right.
to one of the...
No. What happened was we found the guy who made them.
Right.
My father's old associate, Rui Kawashima, works at the Japan Society, had found the young man who soldered these sculptures, who with this, you know, sort of space age material, which you write about in the book, mm-hmm. and he wanted to chat. So it was like, I was going to talk to him, so I was like, let's look at this sculpture, see how it's made. So when I talk to him, I can ask intelligent questions about how it's fabricated. So we figured out a way, we got together, and the owners that had the sculpture before us had drilled holes in the bottom of it for drainage, which is alarming. And so what we did was we were trying to peek through these tiny little holes, and I was like, oh, put our iPhone on it. So we put our phone on it, and we shined the light inside, and all of a sudden we could see inside, and we could make like a model of it and figure out how it was made. You were doing it for your reasons, and I was doing it for my reasons, because I just want to know what it was made out of.
Right. From an inventory perspective, you wanted to know material.
Yeah, and I wanted to know how it was made and talk to the guy who made it and find out what my mother said to him when she was... Because she wouldn't talk to us about the Japan material especially. She would just say, oh, Japan, you know.
And I was interested in those questions as well, but I was really interested in the way Truett ran her studio in Japan was so peculiar. It was like she was the CEO of a multinational corporation. You have to understand this work, when she arrived in Japan, she had to find a studio, she had to find a fabricator who used aluminum. I mean, this is...
Which no artists were having their work made in Japan at the time. They're all...
No.
It was like super shameful to not make your own work.
That's in terms of handicraft.
Yeah, handicraft.
And, and so she found someone who distributed aluminum, who would make the objects to these certain specifications.
Cut the pieces.
Then she had to find another corporation who carried shipbuilding paint in order to paint the sculptures. And then this other guy from a cold solder operation, Nihon Almet, which was a brand new. I mean, this wasn't...
Well, they invented that solder to make new skyscrapers, because after the war in Japan, they thought that was going to be the next big thing, was to be able to make aluminum skyscrapers. So the idea of Almet was that they found this way to make cold solder, so they thought they'd make these giant skyscrapers out of aluminum and solder them. That was their idea, which it never worked out, because they made the skyscrapers out of something else or something. But then Almet ended up being the one who they used the solder for the dials on the shuttle. Was the dials on first on cars, and then the dials on the shuttle was the aluminum, the solder that they could work with. So they ended up being the space program. But that...
And Truett
it was
wanted
a flailing business.
And Truett wanted flailing? This material because it closed the seam.
And
there
made
was a
it
seam
crispy.
On the end to make the seam flush.
Crispy.
Crispy and flush.
Crispy? Crispy.
To make
no?
it
sharp.
Flush. Sharp.
Sharp.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So and that's how it has this really
Oh, the interior
edge.
Is hideous. I mean, the interior is like...
So you know it's... So one phone is shining light inside the sculpture, and the other phone is looking through the camera to see what's inside of it. And that's how it... I know, they're off, but okay. Then we...
Change the picture.
Then we made a maquette to sort of discover this on our own.
Well, because it's not so easy to make. We found out it's not so easy to make them, but that's maybe...
Hours of labor into this one maquette. Anyway...
There's a wall for apricots again.
This is the home that the Truetts lived in a very peculiar neighborhood called Wakamatsucho, which is essentially a very Japanese neighborhood. It really wasn't a place where Westerners lived. And I spend some time in the book talking about what that meant as a sort of discursively. This is a handwritten note about the location of Truett's studio. I'm going through this a little bit quickly because I want to bring us to. This is the interior of the studio that Truett occupied in Japan. Did you want to say anything about this?
Well, you know, only that I still don't know what those things are on the top of the table. Like, I don't know if those are maquettes or if those are little aluminum things or folded aluminum. I don't know what those are.
And the solder guy, Mr. Miyano Mae, he said that when he came to the studio, the sculptures were like sitting on cinder blocks.
He said he built them on a table.
On a table, and then
yeah, he like kept insisting that he did solder on a table. Like, but he said he did. I don't know.
Well, memory is strange.
But yeah, this is, you can see that drawing that you showed before on the table, that the drawing for sculptures, sort of notional sculpture. But I don't know what those maquette things are. And also that's Liquitex, so she must have gotten, this must be later when
later.
She got bright paint. But I don't know, I like that picture. She looks a little sad, but it's a nice picture. Sad? Serious? Serious. Determined.
This is Clement Greenberg with Ann Truett at an exhibition in Japan in 1966. And then this is, if any of you know, if you're Japanese art historians, this is a very special picture on the right. This is a photograph of Truett with Kusuo Shimizu, who was the director of the Minami Gallery, and his archive is very sparse and hard to access, and there's not very much we have in the way of seeing something like this, so this is a very unusual photograph. And this is James Truett with Clement Greenberg. I'm going to abbreviate here simply to say that when Truett came back from Japan in 1967, this is when she had a great deal of career success. Greenberg was commissioned to write an essay about her for Vogue, which you see represented here, entitled Changer. It was in a woman issue, sort of a powerful woman issue of Vogue, May 1968, which is an important date anyway.
What date?
The revolutionary month of May 1968.
Why was that big?
And this is the...
why was that big? Should I know?
May 68 in Paris.
Oh, right.
So, but I think it's an interest, it's fascinating that this is the May 1968 issue of Vogue.
Yeah, but they must have planned that before, it must have been in the works, right? Before?
Of course.
Yeah. And Snowden took that picture.
Lord Snowden took the...
We were told to stay out. We weren't allowed to come home after
and
school.
And there's so infrequently is Truett represent is photographed outside, right?
Well, he took a bunch of pictures inside. I've been trying to get those photographs, but every time we do, they're like, oh, we don't know anything about that. But he took a bunch of pictures inside, and then she said, well, let's go outside. Because she's always trying to get outside. Every time, like when she was working with Jean Pietro in the studio, always outside. Every time anything happens, my mother would always be like, let's go outside. So she'd get outside and she'd say, now, you know, now she can orient herself, she can breathe some air. Or if something happened, she'd be like, go outside. But so she went outside and leaned up against a tree. And then she said he took a picture and that was the great picture. And the rest of them were terrible, she said.
You mentioned Gian Pietro. This is a really nice tie-in because I sort of want to bring us to the end of our time, kind of where we started when thinking about geography, thinking about studios. What I'm showing you, this is the studio that she worked in from 1971 until the end of her life.
When she got the Guggenheim, she built the studio.
So she won a Guggenheim and used the money to build the studio. It also, there were some other important coincidences. She was divorced.
She got a Guggenheim. She built herself a studio in the backyard.
And that represented a real moment of self-sufficiency.
Well, she built the studio. She got her the coordinates that she wanted on the Earth. So, you know, she was where, same longitude, latitude that she was born in Baltimore. She got herself a studio. She got Hugh Jacobson to help her build it. He came over and gave her some, you know, suggestions. She built it like an Easton, Maryland fisherman's shack. She painted it, or she didn't paint it, or she painted it the same color? Is it painted? It's sort of stained, but it's like an East. She say it's like based on a fisherman's shack from Easton. So she made this super simple studio. When she went in it, she hung up her brushes. She put her table where she put it, and nothing ever moved in there. Everything stayed the same from the day that she moved into it till the day she left it. You know, 10 days before she died, everything stayed exactly the same.
And
nothing
you were
ever
never
moved.
Allowed inside.
From time to time, you could hang out, but unless you needed stitches, you weren't allowed to go out there and bother her. Right? Emergency.
The tables on which she worked, the sawhorses, she had sets of sawhorses, and they moved around.
True.
According to the circumstances of what she was working on. And I never felt I would go out to the studio anytime and talk to her. She was actually very fluid. So
Sam got to go whenever he wanted. I wasn't allowed to go out there unless I needed. But there was a sense of, like, you're not supposed to bug mom in the studio, right?
Yeah, maybe.
Would you say a little bit about the store, why the windows are so high?
Oh, the windows are high because Louisa Jenkins, who was an artist in California, who was very important to her when she was in Japan.
A mosaicist.
Mosaicist kind of told her you should make high windows so you have wall space.
Yeah.
So she used that wall space.
I love this photograph of her mixed pigment. Paints. In the
So she'd put the name of the sculptures on the paint jars after she finished using them. Whatever leftover paint she'd have, she'd write the name of the sculpture and then put it on the paint.
I love that. Will you tell a couple words about the split rail fence?
Oh, that split rail fence. She wanted to stay. She was getting older. And so the house is like, this is the studio, and the house was like kind of out of the frame right over here. So every time she would go out to the studio, she'd leave the house, and orient herself, what's the season, what's going on at the sky, go into the studio, and as she got older, she wanted to stay in her house and stay in her studio. She didn't want to go anywhere. She thought about it, but didn't want to go anywhere. And so I was like, why don't you just put up a railing between the house? She almost fell down, so she said, I'm scared to go to the studio. Put up a railing between the house and the studio and just go on this railing. And so she's all like, I'll build a fence. So she decided to build a fence instead of a railing because she likes a fence. So she.
And it was about this idea of being oriented. It was almost like she was kind of recreating Easton.
Right. Well, the fences she used to look through and, yeah. And she didn't need her glasses to get out there. She could just, I mean, she's always taking on or off her glasses. You asked about the myopia before, but if she wanted to mix paint, she'd take off her glasses. If she was painting, she often didn't wear her glasses, so, you know.
So I kind of want to close. We talked about this a little bit earlier, and if you asked Anne Truitt what her favorite artist was.
It's just like Giotto, Piero della Francesca, Matisse's color, but mostly it's not artists, it's like Shackleton, Cicero, Odysseus, you know, these guys, these adventurers, people like that. I mean, it's almost like when she built this studio, she sat in it and set her course, and just like one of her favorite, like Shackleton, she just stayed in her studio and made her work on the right coordinates and just, am I making sense?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's about being oriented in a place.
A place with a horizon in mind, with a view in mind, with a thing, not a journey, that's so corny, but like a
voyage.
A place to go.
A place to go, yeah.
There was, yeah. And that, yeah.
That's all the time we have. But
what?
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for this brilliant and entertaining discussion. And now we move on to book signing in the corridor.